$6,000, and I'm AFDC family of four with no income. And I get my $1,000 check in December. What are you saying? If I don't dispose it, if I just keep my money?
I'm saying that in December, you have $1,000, you'll report it in January. In February, we're required to count that $1,000. And if we elect not to and hold them completely harmless for that month, then we'd be continuing their assistance, but at all state costs rather than 50-50. Each month after that, they would continue to report that $1,000 and be over the limit, and we would continue to support them at full state cost instead of 50-50, unless some hold harmless time frame were put on there. And that's obviously not going to happen in all cases, but there will be some cases where they won't want to dispose of the $1,000 because of the comfort factor it might give them.
Let me ask you if I might. I realize which department you're from, but are there other departments within the state government, not to mention the federal government, that provide gratuities or benefits or entitlements predicated on income? One that comes to my mind is the Fish and Game, the 25-cent hunting license. CNRA may have some.
Daycare.
Is there any such thing as a cookbook for social workers to where you can identify all the programs?
I don't know that there's such a document, but there are, in fact, a number of other programs operate outside of our agency. We didn't include those to give you a better picture of the overall benefits that they're getting because we didn't want to be on the wrong side of somebody's program. But there is a daycare program, of course, and there is the public defenders program, and there is the fishing license.
Could you provide me in the near future with a list of these programs, not whether you support them or not, but just identify there's one out there?
Sure, we'll try to do that for you.
You do?
Very difficult to get it all inclusive. I don't think we could guarantee the completeness.
No, but just privy to what the ones you know of. We'll make inquiries of the AG and several others, because I'm not sure that we're seeing the whole mosaic that's out here, but just...
That's correct. In fact, Mr. Chairman, you are not. And another significant one is Alaska State Housing Authority, where there's subsidized housing. But we don't have access to all their eligibility standards, so we didn't attempt to build in benefit amounts for those. This is just the benefits flowing through the Division of Public Assistance, except for the longevity bonus.
You agree that that figure is $7.5 million, or approximately, that's your best guess,
right?
What the impact would be, if there was the
full whole harness.
Full whole harness.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you very much. Senator Simpson, do you have a question?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, it's obvious that this is a real difficult area, and I'm not particularly comfortable with these figures. I guess what I'd like to have you explain to me is what, in your opinion, would be the ideal way for us to be able to distribute the permanent fund distribution people, our dividend, to the people that are on federally assisted programs right now.
Well, I think the only way you can do it and not have it affect them financially is to do it in the form of a vendor payment. If there's any form of cash transfer, anything that can be construed as a cash transfer, there's no way to disregard it under the federal rules. But a vendor payment can be made and disregarded in the federal programs.
Mr. Chairman, what you would be talking about then if we would pay their
rent or
health
their
or their rent or
electricity
medical insurance or something, and that was one of the alternatives. I know that DVDP did a lot of work, and you get into some problems on that because you're saying one person needs health insurance, but this person doesn't, and so you get into that whole question of equity again. If you're picking out something for you.
That eventually got exploded into kind of a menu type approach that
right.
You send out a list of things and you pick the one you want. But as long as cash was on that list, they were going to have to exercise the cash option. To answer your question, I don't think there's an ideal way in the current environment to do it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
If you could provide us that information as soon as possible, we'd appreciate it. It doesn't have to be formal, just identify the programs and what area of government there.
Mr. Chairman, there was just one other issue that had been brought up by Senator Fisher had to do, and I see that Senator Lawson has put out a handout here about the fathers to support their own children. The point was made where we have a certain amount of the money is not subject to lien is not the appropriate word, but he suggested dropping out the child support portion of it. I wonder if we could have Susan speak to to that issue and if she's had an opportunity to look at the substitute prepared by Legal Services to see if she has any problems. If you could quote the section of the bill, I'd appreciate it.
On the...
The 50%...
It's on page 6 in the per capita alternative. It's at the bottom of the page, section 4323.075. To tell you the truth, I think we, in drafting this, we mostly took the existing statutes and repeated them for purposes of this per capita program, to the extent that upon 2 years of reflection on the drafting of the existing statute, I thought I could improve it. I did. But in terms of the substance, unless something obvious came up that required a change, I didn't. The existing statute is, in substance, the same as section 075 that you have here. The words are slightly different. To tell you the truth, I haven't talked to the governor about the child support issue, and I don't think he would have any particular objection. Where Keith is nodding his head, no, the governor would not have any objection to carving out an exception to this exemption for child support enforcement.
Senator Elias.
Chairman, I was a member of the Committee on this particular issue 2 or 3 years ago. And that particular time, of course, times have changed.
Sure.
The economic conditions have changed. We're having more people come aboard because of non-child support payments. But that particular time, the President said that was very adamant as much as that these people were to get their share of Alaska and they wanted to protect some money for them to receive. Okay, that might have been sound approach 3 years ago, but I think things have changed considerably.
I don't remember Senator Ellison, and I tried to look back and remember whether because I had worked with the free conference back then, whether the particular issue of child support enforcement came up with respect.
Not itself, but
yeah, I don't think we thought, yeah.
The issue was when everyone needed a piece of cash, mm-hmm. had to
yeah.
take some of it.
Yeah, that was the rationale. I couldn't remember the child support enforcement issue actually coming up back in 1980, which may be why we ended up not addressing it in the 1980 legislation. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Susan, do you have any comments on the legislative draft or any other issues that we should have?
No, I reviewed the legislative affairs draft. There were one or two little present tense versus future tense things that I'm sure this committee doesn't care about. Jim Lear and I have talked about those, and it seems to be just fine.
Chairman, it seems to me that just to recap, I think what I've heard, that we need a fiscal note yet from the Health and Social Services. We have the policy issue regarding the public welfare issue. The figures given to us are based on what's currently in the legislation, which is basically the first $1,500 of annual dividends are exempted from determination of income under the state program. Based on financial need. If we would go the other way and have a hold harmless in, we're talking about $7.5 million additional dollars to attempt to rectify that. So, I don't know if you would like to have a motion or what's the pleasure of the group. And the issue that has been raised, I'm sorry, the other issue then would be on whether we would wish to consider the child support being exempted from section 4320.075. In other words, it would we'd have to add just an amendment to with that exception.
Have an amendment drafted?
For on the child support enforcement? Not at the moment, but it would take mere minutes to put together.
Have one.
How long is mere minutes? 10
Pardon
minutes?
Me?
How long is mere minutes? 10 minutes?
10 minutes.
Well, we recess
and
for
10
minutes.
And if Senator Elias has already done it, it's less than that.
It'd be less than that.
Didn't well, maybe you have your order.
You didn't hear mine.
We got out of our seats, too. You were more previous than I was.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Sertuluski.
So I would like to move for the, and ask unanimous consent for the adoption of committee substitute for Senate Bill number 842, Finance. So you'll notify that one that says Lear 4882.
Motion for the committee. All in favor, signify by raising your hand. Motion carried. Adopt the finance version.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator?
I have an amendment. Page 7, line 2. After the period ends, the following language, this exemption does not apply to obligations for child support.
Have a motion before the
Objectives for rereading, please. Where would it be?
Page 7, line 2, after the period. This exemption does not apply to obligations for child support.
Great.
Yes, unanimous consent.
No objection.
Any objection? No objection. Amendment adopted.
Good work.
Good work. Mr. Chairman?
Senator Sturgiski.
I would move that Committee Substitute Senate Bill number 842, Finance, as amended, be moved from committee with individual recommendations.
All in favor of the motion? Motion carried. Bill moved to committee, individual recommendations.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator?
Is it your intent to take testimony on SB 684 this afternoon?
Is there anyone that's here to testify specifically on that bill? Anybody from out of town? Or? Hearing not, we'll move the bill.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, but I believe Mr. Rhodes, who is the executive assistant to the board, has to be out of town the first of next week. I don't know whether he feels he'd like to give his testimony today or what would you.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman,
it
was my attention to join the commission witness at the table. I don't have any prepared remarks, but I would be happy to help the questions if I could get.
I tell you, we'll probably be bringing this bill up again Wednesday or Thursday of next week in that period of time. Anything further come before the committee at this time? We'll be taking up the budget very soon, and the Senate has had calendars and what have you, House Bill 148. We've just received a new budget document over House Bill 666 with various conglomerate amendments and what have you. So any of the things that pertain to 148 will pertain to the new number of 666. This will be coming up early next week and will be posted on the Senate bulletin board as to the appropriate time. Anything further to come before the committee?
Mr. Sorry. You don't have a meeting tomorrow. Then. You do not have a meeting. No plan.
Well, we can.
Okay. So you don't anticipate anything?
I'll be here working on the budget if you want to stop by and have a cup of coffee.
All right.
Call the meeting to order. We have a bill that's going to act on, which we in fact have had testimony on in the past and been up several times. Our old friend Senate Bill 769 and Act. Moving energy program power project from state ownership requirements. Senator Dankler, do you have a question?
Well, the testimony's been there, and I understand you held this just as courtesy to me because it was assigned to me, and I thank you for that. But if there's nothing else, and I don't have any further testimony, I'd move that we move committee substitute for Senate Bill number 769, Finance, with individual recommendations.
All in favor of 769 moving individual recommendations? Bill moved committee individual recommendations. Moving right along, the next bill we'll take up will be Senate Bill 843 relating to surface coal mining and the surface effects of coal mining. Senator Dankler, move that off.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we have a number of people here this morning to testify on this bill. I guess to tell the committee that I personally feel that this is going to be an important piece of legislation. I think we need it. The federal government, of course, set up a system that in 1977 that on reclamation that would allow, I guess, the state and the federal government to participate in regulating and enforcing the standards and procedures for coal mine operations as it pertains to reclamation and other things. So this bill authorizes us to do that. And without waiting, spending too much time, let me ask Senator Farenkamp, who's the author of this legislation, if she'd like to come forward or who she would like to testify on this bill. Would you like to testify, Betty?
I can make mine very short and sweet. A couple of members of this committee have already been through it. We have analysis of the federal bill, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, along with the analysis of the state bill. I think you have this in your backup material. Also, I'd like to bring to your attention in your backup material, second paragraph, that the state legislature adjourns without having passed the requisite bill. The department schedule for proposing implementing a federal program is moving up to require publication a proposed program within 120 days of legislative adjournment. So it's, I guess I'm just wearing my trust me button when I tell you that we've been through it. I talked to OSM in San Francisco last weekend, and they're fairly pleased with our bill. We're holding off a bit on regulations because they're rewriting the regs and be out in July. And I think other than that, I just say, trust me, we need it. We've been through it very thoroughly. I'll answer questions if John's here or others.
Thank you, Betty. I think for the purpose of, because it is a pretty important piece of legislation, maybe we'd ask Commissioner Katz or his representatives to come forward and explain the bill just what it does.
I am pleased, Mr. Chairman, to appear here today in support of this legislation. My remarks will be similarly very brief. The bill does reflect a very arduous process, which has included four major revisions over the last 2 years. It's a very complex piece of legislation, as you all know, and for that reason, the department felt the need to go through an analytic process that has rivaled few bills in my experience. That process included very detailed consultation with the mining industry, which would be affected by this legislation, by public interest groups and others. I think I can reflect on the basis of that process that the coal industry does support this legislation, that public interest groups have heartburn with certain provisions, but basically support its enactment, and that we have resolved all the outstanding issues I know of with sister state agencies. I don't think that this legislation certainly does not reflect my personal philosophy of federal-state relations, and probably not the philosophy of very many people in this room. It is the product of a series of abuses which occurred mainly in the eastern states over a course of many years before we had the matrix of environmental legislation that we have now. It is an extremely comprehensive federal law and really doesn't leave all that much flexibility for state enactment. Nevertheless, I very strongly recommend to the committee that we adopt this legislation. We have investigated and determined that there is no reasonable likelihood of congressional amendment in the near future on any major provision. Litigation has already been threatened, and if we do not enact the legislation, I'm certain that that will result in a federal takeover of the program. We have sought in this legislation to push the federal parameters to their limits in all instances, and to make the bill as responsive as we could to the unique situation which we believe Alaska represents. We've done that in consultation with the Federal Office of Surface Mining and have been advised by letter that there, at that point, was only one problem in our proposed statute, and that problem has since been resolved by virtue of action taken by the Senate Resources Committee. I've looked at the fiscal note for this legislation with some care. The four positions which we are requesting, I am told, are absolutely essential to implement the program. And the Federal Office of Surface Mining requires not only the statutory authority to implement the program, but the actual physical capacity to do it. This fiscal note would assure us of that physical capacity. As I've testified on other bills, it's my judgment that our Division of Minerals and Energy Management is one of the most efficient components of the Department of Natural Resources. They are overworked now, in my judgment, and we looked at the possibility of implementing this program with existing people by taking certain segments of their time. It just did not work. In this instance, at least, we need those additional bodies. The fiscal note that you have reflects a very significant federal share for the various components of the surface program, such that the total amount in the first fiscal year would be approximately $563,000, but the state share would be only $162,000. And that does reflect various federal formulae in different components for helping the states to implement this program. I think with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll stop and respond to questions if the committee has any.
Senator Sackett.
Commissioner, under contractual, you have $375,000 you're requesting, with just a one-sentence explanation and no breakdown at all. Do you have any better breakdown than what you provided us?
Yes, we can do that. I'll say in one additional sentence that we felt that that was a better way to go than to utilize existing personnel for a couple of components relating to small operator assistance and to the abandoned mine program. But with that, let me ask Howard Reutman to come up and elaborate.
Let me interrupt. It doesn't even say that.
Okay, well,
all it says is much of this work is speculative. It's based on projections about future development of the program at the end of it, but it doesn't say what the other contractual reports specifically for.
Okay, well, I'm sorry about that, but let me see if we can rectify that problem now. Mr. Reutman is a consultant to the Department of Natural Resources who's been assisting us on the legislation and our relations with the Federal Office of Surface Management for several months now.
That figure was derived from the following breakout. The largest segment of it is $200,000 for development of an abandoned mine land program. The state is entitled to have such a program and receive 100% funding from the federal government if its regulatory program, which is established in this bill, is approved. That $200,000 figure represents 100% federal contribution. Likewise, $40,000 was for a small operator assistance contract. That also represents 100% federal contribution. The other parts of it were $60,000 for review of permit applications and mine plans. These permit applications are very extensive, complicated technical documents. Western mines typically may have a 20-volume permit application, and it was assumed that the department would need outside help in reviewing these things, since it didn't make sense to staff up to review that complex a document across a very broad range of disciplines. The other parts of it are $20,000 for legal assistance in development, final promulgation of regulations, and in legal review of permit applications and any enforcement actions, and $55,000 in continuing program development tasks, such as development of a manual and training for the new staff that will be hired, development of a cooperative agreement with the federal government to govern state authority on federal lands in the state.
Okay, let me interrupt. Just one more question, please. On the $200,000 for abandonment of land programs, how do you come to that figure? And the other question, just one more question, is that the next year, fiscal year 84, you increased up to nearly $500,000 just in contractual alone, with no backup, nothing. And the only concern I have is that at some point in time, probably by next year, the federal government is going to cut back on their share, and we're going to have to step in and fill it. And I kind of like to know what we're filling.
Well, I apologize for that. I had that material and didn't have it included in the note. The reason for the increase in next year is that we assume that that's when we're going to see the bulk of major operations coming in, the permit applications. According to the operators in the Beluga area, that's when we should see those applications coming in. That's when I projected a potential operation up at Jarvis Creek to come in, and there are a couple of others like that. And the bulk of the money, the new money there, is in reviewing the permit applications. Again, to review one of these things in detail, you need a staff of 20 people across a range of disciplines, very broad range. The $200,000 for abandoned mine land program development, I based on a series of calls and letters to other western states reviewing their program development for abandoned mine lands. I took the lowest figure and then reduced it some, since I felt that there were comparatively fewer sites up here that we were looking at. What's involved here is taking an inventory of all the potential abandoned mine sites in the state, developing some kind of priority system for which ones the state would deal with, contracting out work to begin dealing with the highest priority sites, developing the regulations that govern these things. Those are the components of that figure.
No further questions.
Go, David.
Commissioner, would you see that we're given a breakdown as in the answer to Senator Sackett's questions for the purpose of our policy? What you just told us.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to have that. But
yes, sir. We have it, and I apologize for not getting it to you. That will not happen again.
And any other questions?
Thank you. Commissioner, would you share with us what some of the concerns were of the environmental groups and how they've been addressed in this bill?
I was not able to be present when they presented their testimony in the Senate Resources Committee, so with your indulgence, I'm going to ask Howard to do that.
I'm afraid I didn't bring the material that they presented to us. They offered a series of, if I recall, 9 potential amendments aimed at strengthening different parts of the bill. They included beefing up enforcement, requiring higher penalties in the event of violations, as I recall, making it easier to find that an operator had established he's guilty of a pattern of violations, which under the law, the federal law, can lead to revocation of a permit. They wanted to make bond release both more difficult and to clear up a little bit of the process that's reflected in the bill, and the regulations on that I'm drafting would be responsive to that concern. It probably wasn't as clear as it could have been in the bill. We inherited that language from Congress, but I intend to make it clear in the regulations that the kind of stage release of bonds, if there's always adequate bond involved, we would ensure that takes place. That was one of their concerns. They object.
Senator Farrenkamp, are you seeking?
I was just going to bring this extension of attention. I think he has a minute to all the resource committees and
how would you have that in?
Mr. Chairman, I just gave the copies of the actually had come from the environmental community. A number of those issues were discussed, and I have some notes there that indicate some of the things were requirements of the federal program, and I don't think I'm prepared to speak on each one.
One of the amendments they requested was the small operator assistance program be deleted, and that's required by federal law, for example. And there were, as Howard said, several cases where they wanted to tighten up provisions so that they were stronger than the federal requirements.
Well, are you comfortable that most of the concerns are addressed then in either this legislation or the regulations that will be promulgated?
I'm comfortable that with a combination of the two. Of course, we haven't finished the regulatory drafting process. The regulations are absolutely integral to this legislation, and we have, in fact, started that process in consultation with the same groups that we have worked with before, but I thought it was a little bit unseemly for us to promulgate regulations before you enact the statute, so we've slowed that process, and I can't represent that we will address all the environmentalist concerns, because it would not be at least my philosophical approach to go further than the federal requirements would require. But to the extent that they have raised some of the other kinds of problems that Howard is talking about, we would propose to address those in regulations.
Senator Dankwart.
Well, just one last question. Is there any chance, Commissioner, have y'all been advised in any way that the federal government plans to pull out of this program? I mean, their financing. This isn't something that we're trying to get our nose under the tent because they're bailing out or something.
I was concerned about that, too, and I probed that a little bit, and I don't see any indication, perhaps Howard would want to elaborate, that they are contemplating that. And really, in this instance, I don't think they can, because they're imposing a very onerous statutory framework on the states you know, which is, I guess, not unprecedented, but is unusual even in the federal structure. And for them not to provide the requisite financing, I think would be a rationale for a number of states coming back and indicating they just did not have the economic wherewithal to implement the program.
Thank you, John.
Can I elaborate on that just a small amount? Probably half of the budget in the first year fiscal note comes out of the Federal Abandoned Mine Land Fund, which is composed solely of contributions from coal operators. They've been paying in 35 cents a ton for surface mine coal since 1977. That fund is very large. It's not even subject to direct congressional appropriation. So I think that part of the program is very sure. The rest of it, the federal law does mandate that the secretary supply 50% of the rest of the law of the program costs and 100% of the costs for the state to administer the program on federal lands in the state. And so any cutback on that would be in conflict with the federal law. And I might also add that Congress has never, even the most recent Congress, made substantial cuts in the portion of the OSM program that goes to state programs.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
There's no further questions. I'd move that we move out committee substitute for Senate Bill number 843, Resources on Individual Recommendation.
We have a motion for the committee to move the bill out on individual recommendation. All in favor of the motion? Opposed? Bill moves the individual recommendation. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was
concerned. Stacks of material.
Nothing financial, though. These are just minutes.
The 517, Act Relating to Child Care.
Mr. Chairman, the original 517, as introduced by Senator Parr last year, most of that material was included in another bill, so what we've done with what is left is to draft a committee substitute which addresses the period, which lengthens the period of payment for a loan for a child care facility from 10 to 20 years. Last year, as you recall, we increased the maximum loan from $30,000 to $50,000, but somehow or other we overlooked the repayment schedule in effect by remaining with a 10-year payback that a lot of facilities were not able to apply for the additional monies which are available because that makes it unfeasible for repayment. I checked with the original sponsor, Senator Parr, and he has no objections to us taking the title and rewriting the bill, which extends the duration of repayment from 10 to 20 years. There's a fiscal note of a zero, and we have a member of the person in the Department of Commerce and Economic Development, Rick Winokur, is available if you have any questions on the program itself.
The only thing this does is extend the repayment contract
from 10 to 20.
Any members have any questions? Do we have a motion?
Chairman, I move committee substitute for individual recommendations.
All in favor of moving the bill on individual recommendations? Opposed? Bill moved individual recommendations.
Zero fiscal note.
Zero.
What percent interest is that?
Next bill we have is committee substitute for House Bill 154, Act Related to Financial Disclosure.
Oh, this is a bad.
We have the director present from APOC. Ed, you want to come forward? We'll.
My name is Theda Pittman, and I am the Executive Director for the Alaska Public Offices Commission. I'd just like to mention briefly some of the items that the Commission requested be made as amendments to AS 3950, the Conflict of Interest Law. In Section 1, the bill establishes an April 15th due date for a conflict of interest statement, which is filed by a person who becomes a state candidate between January 1st and April 15th. The reason for that simply is that under the present law, the person files a declaration of candidacy January 1 or afterwards. The statute suggests that they have to file their conflict of interest statement immediately. And because of the need to provide to find to get your financial records together from the previous calendar year. That becomes a problem for people. It seemed reasonable to establish the same April 15th deadline for those people that that exist for people who are already in office and updating their conflict of interest statement. The other change that the commission sought in Section 1 was to require that those who become state candidates in a year prior to an election update their conflict of interest statement annually through the date of the election. As it stands now, individuals who are not in office, who became candidates in 1981, file conflict of interest statements covering calendar year 80. That's the only statement they'll be required to file through the date of the election. And requiring them to update their statements would then put all of the candidates for state elective office in terms of the same information covering the same calendar years would be on file for them. The other changes the commission has asked for in Section 3, raising the threshold at which sources of income must be reported from over $100 to over $5,000. The over $100 level is, as some of you are well aware, an incredible burden for people who have clients or customers that have to be reported or have renters. And it was the commission's feeling that by raising the threshold to more than $5,000, the items that appeared on the statements under sources of income would be the more significant items in terms of the individual's financial holdings. They recommended that same change in the requirement to list loans or loan guarantees or credit obligations, that the threshold be raised from over 100 to over 5,000. They also recommend removal of the phrase, or the requirement to report financial business information for non-dependent children who are living with the reporting official. The situation that most of those represent are college students who maintain an address at home but are in fact financially independent. And the commission believes that that should be removed from the requirement to report sources of income, business interests, real property, trusts, and loans. They did not recommend removing it from contracts and natural resource leases because there's a perception, correctly or not, that those are two areas in which public officials have the ability to influence who receives those. And when you look at those two sections, you note that the list of people you have to report for is longer than it is for the other items. Those are on page 4, starting with line 5. The lists of contracts, it includes dependent child, non-dependent child, mother, father, spouse, partnership or professional corporation, business interest as well, as does the requirement that starts on line 16 in terms of mineral, timber, oil, or any other natural resource leases. And so they did not recommend that the non-dependent child who's living with them be removed from those two sections. And then finally, the items that the commission this year initiated and requested. Section 5 adds charter commission members to the requirement of those required to file a conflict of interest statements because of the impact on the communities of the work that's done by charter commission members. And Section 6 is an effort to eliminate the requirement that service area candidates have to file conflict of interest statements. As the law is presently written, service area board members do not have to file annual statements, but since they do run for office, they have to file them when they're candidates. And that, according to the municipalities around, is perceived as a thankless job. Having to do anything in order to be a candidate for a service area board is something of a difficulty. Those are the changes that the commission recommended. I've noticed that there's one other item that dropped out of the change from state affairs, and it's an item that was in the original bill. She said confidently. Oh. 154 originally had a section that said a campaign contribution reported by a public official or candidate under AS 1513 does not need to be reported under this section. And that isn't in this version, and I don't know if that just dropped out or something else.
Repeat that again.
A campaign contribution reported by a public official or a candidate under AS 1513 does not need to be reported under this section.
Where are you?
Mr. Chairman, that's what, that's the campaign disclosure law.
Which is the citing, though, in the old bill?
Oh, it was section 4. Yeah, but it's not in the, it's not in the finance version of section 4.
What does that actually mean? You talk about contributions to a political campaign?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And as I said, that was in the original 154. I can't tell you precisely why it was in there, or whether it was just because questions had been asked, whether if candidates took their surpluses as income, if that meant they had to report them as sources of income, or if it was just an effort to clarify that that those were not.
Could it possibly correlate with the Finance Committee's substitute on page 2, line 27? Sources of income over $5,000 and a campaign contribution cannot be over
$5,000. Oh, okay. That may be the case, although it's possible that the accumulated, if you're talking about the surplus from a campaign, that it could be more than $5,000.
That's the only thing I can see in the bill. It might be a reason why the drafters dropped it out. No one can contribute that amount.
Okay. There is one. There's an item on page 4, line 18.
Line what?
Line 18. The phrase "a spouse" should be changed to "the spouse," so then it will read. Actually, it needs a little more than that. I'm sorry. The spouse, probably the spouse or dependent child of the public official or candidate. A spouse kind of hangs out there with without this kind of clarity of whose spouse it is they're talking about.
Couple of questions. On page 2 now, at the bottom of the page, the source of all income over $5,000, including capital gains, has to be reported. If you make less than $5,000, you don't have to report anything. Is that what that says? So if you don't do nothing, you don't have to file anything for office.
Oh, you don't have to report what is now part 3, the source of income. There are still requirements to report your involvement with businesses, stockholders, you're a stockholder, a director, an owner, a partner, those kinds of things. There's still a requirement to report real property.
Even if you don't make $5,000, you still have to do all that?
The holding of real property. The source of income is apart from the listings of the other interests.
Wait a minute, apart from all the other, you, regardless of what you make, maybe I don't misunderstand, but this says that the source of all income over $5,000, if you make less than $5,000 on anything, your total income is less than $5,000, you don't do anything but live on food stamps and live in a cabin somewhere, you can run across, you don't have to fill this out, because you're not going to own stock or anything.
Unless you have.
I mean, the poor you get if you don't own nothing, you don't work or anything, you don't have to declare that. Mm-hmm. But if you go out and have a few dollars and work for a living, you have. 915 says are a combination of them hold a controlling interest. In dealing with the public corporation, you read number 7 as saying that it says list all contracts and offers to contract with the state during the preceding calendar year and so on, or a partnership or professional corporation which the public official apparently holds a controlling interest. If you do not hold a controlling interest, if you only own 49% of the company, is it necessary under this bill that you report that? It's, and I'm reading the section from section 11 through 15. If I own 49% of a company and I don't own the controlling interest, what would I be required to do under that?
I just want to look at something for a second in terms of the statute.
I The first part would indicate that you might have to list, it says a list of all contracts, say during the preceding calendar year, held, said, or offered by the official or candidate. But if he doesn't do that, but yet he owns stock, but not the controlling interest in a company, mm-hmm. and the company tries to bid with someone, then apparently they wouldn't be required to do that as long as he doesn't own the controlling stock.
I would tend to agree with you, but I would have to have a fallback position and do a little consultation, because what I was looking at was the definition in the statute of source of income, because under source of income, it doesn't matter whether you have a controlling interest in the professional corporation or not. You still have to list the sources of income. The same is true of partnerships. It doesn't matter if you have a controlling interest or not. But the statute is a little clearer, because when it goes through that phrase, it after it gets done with the laundry list, but if he's self-employed by means of a sole proprietorship, partnership, professional corporation, or a corporation in which he or his spouse or his children or a combination of them hold a controlling interest, the source is the client or customer, and then it repeats of the proprietorship, partnership, or corporation. And hence the commission has had to require people who had ownership in professional corporations to report sources of income, even though their ownership was not a controlling one. It would be my initial impression that in this situation one wouldn't, but frankly I'd have to have a little chat with Pat Kennedy and
Do you think sometimes, you know, I asked this for the last 6 years that I've been down here, it seems like since this silly law's been in effect. It seems like they've made it so complicated. You've gone pages and pages and all kind of, if you own this and if your child owns that and if your wife got this and you have to report that. I think I could write this whole thing in one paragraph. You know, it just looks like it needs to be rewritten, and a good drafter could come back and say that a candidate that files for office lists all of his financial holdings or something, and it just looks like it could be worded in one sentence. But they go pages, and even you that run it can't answer that question. How do you expect the poor guy out there running for the city council or Ed Dankworth to sit and figure this out? And do you know we just nearly passed a law that if I figure it wrong, I can go to jail for a crime? I think, what was it that we're going to be guilty of something? It's punishable by $5,000 a year in jail, not only if I didn't do it, but if somebody else misunderstood. And you run the organization and you can't answer the question. And that's why this bill is getting worse and worse and worse as the years go by. We just keep trying to, pretty soon you're going to have to get a permit and the permission from the government to participate in it. And I'm just making my little speech. I do this every year that bill comes up. But it's a shame that the American people are giving up their First Amendment rights and have to go and fill out all these forms to participate in government and get their permission and go to jail if they make a mistake in any word. And particularly when it's going to be interpreted by somebody that doesn't even understand it themselves.
I'll send you a copy of my little index card which says a person is not guilty because an agent of the government says so.
I understand. Okay, my speech is over. It's not directed at you. Please don't believe that.
Your speech is getting better each year. And longer.
I'm getting better. I'm getting a little more worked up over it.
Can we adopt a committee substitute?
Have most adopt the committee substitute. All in favor, adopt the document. With the change on,
Mr. Chairman,
page 4, line 18.
We're going to discuss your bill.
I just wanted to raise a question before we adopt that. Theta, one of the other provisions that you haven't addressed is the exemptions for people in the medical profession. I would just like to have your thoughts on that.
Are we referring to the old bill?
No.
That's the point that we're trying to get the committee substitute together so we can talk about that particular issue. They're different.
Okay, you want the committee substitute before us first?
It's considerably expanded over the original bill.
All right, I'll remove my objection, Mr. Chairman.
I have a problem with also.
So you're bringing the bill that you had the problems with before.
Right. That's
the
committee substitute.
Okay. I remove my objection, Mr. Chairman.
There's a motion for us to adopt the Finance Committee substitute. All in favor? Substitute's adopted. Moving right along.
Mr. Chairman, if I could ask my question. It's Theta. You heard my question. I'd like to the commission's response to the changes regarding medical profession exemptions?
I don't have a complete commission response. I know that Commissioner Holmes was of the opinion that in terms of doctors, and she used the phrase healthcare professionals, that she felt there was a different relationship between patient and a doctor, and one that was not predicated upon financial interests or, you know, that was a personal relationship that would make some sense to exempt patients of doctors. And she used the phrase healthcare professionals, and so I assume that she did mean that. I have to admit that I can understand your concern in terms of the length of the list. In terms of legally, the Supreme Court case that was brought by the doctor in Kodiak, Falcon versus the state of Alaska, the Supreme Court's opined that the areas in which there should be exemptions for patients were those who were patients of psychiatrists, psychologists, and doctors whose primary treatment was in contraception and abortion, and that those were the areas in which there ought to be automatic exemptions, and that people could seek exemptions for other specific cases, which is the possibility, and that certainly does not, and there's some rather strong language in that case that suggests that there's nothing particularly embarrassing about having it known that you're the client of a particular dentist or physical hygienist.
Mr. Chairman, you mean the question would be as to whether it embarrasses somebody or not?
That's
one of the measuring points as to whether we fill this thing out as to whether not the right of the people to know.
That's what the court discussed, was the balance between, they don't use the word embarrassment, they use opprobrium, serious opprobrium, and the balance of the
court's right to know. But if I'm going to vote, the purpose for all this is so that I'll know something about the candidate and where he gets his money, and he's getting it from committing abortions out here, but yet they don't want to embarrass anybody, so he doesn't have to do it. But if Ed Dankwart goes out and does something over here in the business world or something, they want to know how much my kid borrowed from somebody or how much my wife inherited. But on those key issues that I think are very instrumental when I go to select a candidate in those areas, of whether he's committing abortions or not for money, may be of great, great interest to me as to whether I want to vote for him.
If I might, I think we're getting off. That's not in the bill at all.
Mr. Chairman.
What she's talking about?
Well, what she's talking about is not in the bill, if you're talking about where the money comes from.
Ms. Chairman.
Well,
I wonder if I'm correct in how I read this, that a public official, any candidate, we're talking now about chiropractors, dental hygienists, druggists, dentists, medicine, nursing, opticians, optometrists, pharmacists, physical therapists, psychologists, that the file for office under a covered office have to report everything like all the rest of us do, their business involvement, our stocks, our bonds, etc. The thing we do not have to under the Finance Committee substitute is to give the amount that they receive from a patient, client, or customer. And that's the only portion that is affected. Isn't that correct in the intent? So it would be if I go to get my teeth done by Dr. Miller, I've gone to for 30 years, he doesn't have to show that, but he has to show any kind of other that he may or any investment that fits under the act.
The only thing, he's like, if you will, he puts him like a grocery store owner or a clerk. He doesn't have to put that Arliss Drzewski spent $1,200 for a sack of groceries, any more than would a dentist have to put down that he did $450 worth of dental work for Arliss Drzewski. He still has to report everything else, other than he does not have to give the name of the patient that he received money from if it was received in a professional relationship, a doctor-patient relationship.
Mr. Chairman, doesn't that $5,000 cover that particular aspect of it as far as...
Not necessarily. You could go in and have surgery. You could have any number of things that would far exceed $5,000.
But I'm talking about those particular cases that do not exceed $5,000. In either case, you'd be exempt from naming those particular persons. Is that correct?
I couldn't hear all what you said. They.
I see you've got a bill from a dentist. Say $1,500. You still would not report it, right?
That's right.
Well, it gets $5,000.
That's right.
So, I don't know how many of these people, I suspect maybe they all get more than $5,000 for their service. The problem I have is that there are no more you're saying some of us have to report and others because of certain circumstances, which really, you know, aren't that compelling. I don't think that maybe we should exempt medicine. That's been exempted by the Porter Center, say, or maybe a psychologist, but as far as a chiropractor or a dentist, you know, who cares whether you go there or not?
Well,
the relationship is different than an attorney and his client or a medical doctor and his client.
But there's a difference in that attorneys you always select. You don't always have a choice of selecting a physician or a health care provider. You have absolutely no choice if you're brought in on a gurney in a hospital. You could be treated by Karl Marx if you had a medical license and was authorized to practice. But the only thing that this is an attempt to do, we have a case, I think, right now that in fact been referred to the Attorney General to prosecute a dentist for the fact that he had filed for the school board and he didn't list everybody that in fact he'd had in his dental chair and has had as a patient. And this is an attempt to get away from this nonsense.
But then the question remains, why shouldn't he list it? Everybody else is listing it.
Well, then why shouldn't the gas station owner list everybody that pulls up?
If you have $5,000 worth of gas, maybe you should.
Well, you probably do.
But the point is that, I think the point is that if your relationship between a dentist and a patient, I think is considerably different than between a medical doctor and a patient. Maybe they have some good grounds there. Or, you know, or optometrist. Who cares, you know, what the patient's names are.
It's not a matter of who cares. That's precisely it, Senator. Nobody cares, so why bother making a list of all their patients?
Because we're doing the same thing. That's
well, if you're seeing patients, you are. Because they have to be a certain
profession to be examined.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Sturtusky.
Yes, just for clarification. Am I correct that this section we're discussing here, if that were not in and we left the law as it is now, that all of the health providers would only have to report sources over 5,000?
That's right.
So I guess they could take care of my teeth until I get to a really big problem. So it would vastly cut down the percentage that would have to be reported. Is that correct?
I assume that it would make a substantial impact because of raising the level to 5,000.
Yeah.
The court case I was mentioning earlier makes those four automatic exemptions, patients, a psychologist, psychiatrist, et cetera, and allows other people to apply for an exemption. Dr. Hansen applied for an exemption, but there was no grounds upon which the commission could grant it based on the existing law and the case history of that court case.
Just one last observation to kind of cap my speech, though, but to go along with what you were saying, it just is unbelievable to me that we have doctors and dentists and everybody have to go do all this. What does that have to do with the guy wanting to file for the House of Representatives or run for the city council? And he has to list all this stuff, and the grocery man would have to list all of his clients and the people who sell gas over a certain amount. The whole thing is just getting absolutely silly. At public expense.
Mr. Chairman, I will only say for the part of the commission, I think they've labored mightily both in this and also in the campaign reporting, as a matter of fact, to clean up some problems. Part of the legislature has not addressed them since they got it, and it's caused them all kinds of problems. I think they're in here trying to lessen some of the burdens, and I certainly support you in that approach.
Well, I agree with that.
Yeah.
Senator Lyson?
Would you list those four exemptions the court had made?
Patients of a psychiatrist.
Psychiatrist, okay.
Psychologist.
Okay.
And of a doctor whose primary purpose is known to be contraception or abortion and venereal disease. I think that's one that I
would fall under classification of medicine, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, psychiatry would too.
So we're really 864 and 886 are the ones that the courts have said could be exempt. The rest of them are.
Any further questions?
A final observation about an item that I believe Mr. Bradley has tried to address on page 4, line 27. Maybe he can help me describe it. Senators Eliason and Stimson may remember out of Senate State Affairs, one of the suggested amendments was a requirement to list liquor licenses and limited entry permits. But in looking at this, and this is the language that initially went in looking at it, it doesn't specify who the owner is in the same way the patterns of the other sections do. I did a little bit of research and determined that limited entry permits are owned by individuals. Liquor licenses are sometimes owned by partnerships, corporations. To take that language, an asset or liability valued at over $5,000 owned by the reporting official, and go through the pattern all the way through partnerships and corporations, it would appear it would add a great deal more than was envisioned by the initial suggestion. And Dick, I talked to Dick Bradley about it a little bit on the phone. Neither of us have come up with a solution short of some kind of specific mentioning those two items if they need to go in, but that one is the kind of, as it appears now, I'm saying is it's a big broad thing that I suspect no one intended or would really want to see in there when it comes through.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr.
Joseph?
Question, not if you want to pursue the point at another point. Mr. Chairman, back on the health providers, food doctors and so on, what if I'm a dentist and you're my client or patient or customer or whatever, but also I happen to be dealing in real estate and I sell you land? Have I excluded you by this wording, or is it clear in here that it's just in that professional relationship as a doctor, dentist, and so on that you're covered? Because you might be a patient in one case and a client if I'm a real estate dealer. I don't know. I'm not being clever. I just don't know. Maybe Mr. Bradley can assist us with that. John, I'm sure that was not the intent of it, but I don't know whether it would need something in the professional capacity or...
Well, the initial intent was to exclude
income. Sure.
Between patient and healthcare providers, period.
Yeah, I understand that.
Exempt that to where physicians or healthcare providers did not have the list. Now, if there's an amendment, that's fine.
Mr. Chairman, I don't even know if there's a problem. That's the reason I raise it. I just don't know.
I have a draft here.
Mr. Bradley, the drafter, I don't know if he drafted for you or not, Dick Bradley from Legal Services. Would it be appropriate to direct the question?
Yeah, certainly. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, it looks to me as though the language is adequate, but I did not think about that question before. It says that a public official or candidate is not required to report the name of a person who is a patient, client, or customer. And I assume that what you are talking about is income received in that capacity.
Correct. That's only.
And not in some other capacity with a coincidental relationship. My assumption is that the language is clear. You can always tighten it up, however, if you're concerned about it.
Well, these immortal words become writ somewhere so that there doesn't become a problem for the commission in carrying it out. That's the only thing. Mr. Chairman, if Mr. Bradley feels that's adequate, so it would be just in that professional relationship, I'd like to direct that question about the item that was left out of the state of affairs version, which was section 4, page 4, talked about a campaign contribution reported by a public official or candidate. It does not need to be reported under this section. Am I correct, Ms.
I must say that I do recall when you were discussing this earlier, I didn't recall why it was deleted. And the reason why it was deleted was because the suggestion, the State Affairs Committee substituted a new subsection over subsection D. And rather than simply make a D, E, and F, I assumed that it was the intent of the committee to delete that particular. I did not do it because I thought it was covered someplace else.
Okay.
It did it rather because it seemed that the draft that was given to us indicated that that section was to be deleted. That is why it is deleted.
Chairman, I think we could probably clarify the language as it relates to the exemptions. If we were to, number one, I think that we ought to address the exemptions that the court has required us to do, and that those are medicine and psychologists. The rest of them, I would suggest we delete those, we amend those sections out. And if we would amend those different sections out and leave the medicine and psychologist in, then we can delete the words out of on line 4, page 5, client or customer. So we're talking about medical doctors and psychologists and his relationship as a patient, period. Drop the word customer. A customer doesn't only relate probably to a pharmacy. I suspect they call those customers. But if that was taken out, it would be very clear, at least in my mind, that we're talking about a patient, either of a doctor or a psychologist, period.
If I might, Senator Elias, point out that the court did not rule on medical doctors. And I might also point out that a psychologist is not a medical doctor. A psychiatrist is. There's some fine lines in here. Mm-hmm. And the thing that we're trying to establish, or was trying to establish in this particular segment, is that things that go on between health care providers and patients should not be reported by name. And that's exactly what is done. Now, it puts a fly in the ointment if this bill passes, and it's an if, with the $5,000 limitation. That obviously eliminates a lot. But when this was put in, the limitation was $100. And every citizen that's gone to any doctor or what have you, his name is on that roll. Many physicians, many dentists, many optometrists and what have you, have got literally 3, 4, 5, 6, 7,000 people that in fact have been to them that would have to be reported. And by and large, if in fact it purely a doctor or a medical health care provider relationship with a patient, the feeling was that it should not be exposed, if you will, in public under a campaign situation. And there's nothing more, nothing less. We weren't trying to say dentists are better or physicians are worse or what have you. But the court case did not exclude medical doctors. It only excluded four entities, of which none of them were identified specifically as medical doctors or surgeons or the rest of it.
Chairman, but did the court address the chiropractors or dental hygienists or pharmacists? So I guess what I'm saying is that this was not addressed by the courts, and we have the $5,000 threshold now.
Well, maybe if this bill passes intact, which it may or may not. If it doesn't, you're back to $100. I mean, if you want to make a motion, I mean, that's fine, but I would say that you better make the motion identifying those that you do want, because in fact, I don't think what the court was addressing solves your problem. The court was interpreting existing law, but what we're attempting to do here is make law which will in future be interpreted.
Mr. Chairman, if in fact we have a blanket exemption for medicine, that would include the reference you made that the court made to certain types of medical doctors, right?
Except for psychologists, licensed psychologists?
I'm talking about the medicine. That would cover all medical doctors. And if we address the psychologists and psychological associates, that would take care of the other problem. We might be exempted more than what the courts actually indicate we should, but at least we've taken care of those two. Well, the question remains, of course, if we had the $5,000 threshold, why the others should be exempted? I mean, any more than other professionals.
It's a stipulation as whether we have the $5,000 exemption or not. That's only predicated if the law passes and if the governor signs it into law. We may or may not have it. As I said earlier, we have $100. That's what we have. Probably in this bill, if it had my intent, it would have been all monies exchanged between patient and health care providers, period. That simple one line. But make your motion, and we'll vote it.
Mr. Chairman, just to move us along, I would have some problems dropping out medicine and psychologists. I think if we act, we should not, we should state in law what we want rather than go back to a court case that does not cover the whole, or the title of medicine. I really don't feel this is as necessary if the 5,000 passes, because it will cut so many out. On the other hand, under the present law of 100, I can see, I believe the chairman of the commission is probably right, that this is not a necessary kind of thing. As long as we know in there, the involvement of these professionals in other things have to be covered, I think that's really where the issue is, as opposed to who fixes teeth or who gets a patched up at a doctor's office.
I guess, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Lassen?
We're back. I suspect that if, in fact, we do not adopt the $5,000 threshold, then these people are going to have to report anything over $100. Well, so will other people in other businesses.
It's not true, Senator Lassen. Your grocery store doesn't, your service station doesn't, you're right on down the line.
They exceed $100?
That's right, they don't. They're exempted. Any retail trade is exempted. Isn't that correct?
That's
any
by
retail
commission
trade. I can have an art show.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. They're all exempted.
Retail business doing business on a cash basis.
The attorneys, clients relationship?
They have. They report. The attorneys report.
So anyone who goes to an attorney and spends more than $100 has to make out the laundry list.
Right.
What other professions?
Real estate, CPA. Those are the...
CPA's exemplars probably has a long list of clients they have to disclose.
And the only rationale that was considered on this, Senator Eliason, was that in medicine you don't have a choice if you're sick, especially in many areas of the state where there's only one dentist or one optometrist or one what have you. You don't have a choice. Where attorneys, you do have a choice, or you have an option not to have an attorney represent yourself. Same way in real estate and all the rest of it, you don't necessarily have to go to one person. And this is really the only logical aspect of it, is that a person who is ill and needs medical care has to go.
Mr. Chairman, were there others that wanted to testify?
Is there anyone else here who wishes to offer testimony on this bill? Do we have any motions on this bill?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we pass Finance Committee substitute for House Bill number 154 out with individual recommendations.
All in favor of the motion? Opposed? Bill passes with individual recommendation. Okay, we have one change on page 4. Thank you. We have a few bill assignments here to be read off. SR 25, establishing the Senate Special Committee for Alaskan Fisheries, Senator Eliason. HJR 71, proposing amendment to the Constitution of the State of Alaska relating to incurring general obligations, Senator Eliason. Senate Bill 457, enacting making special appropriations relocating the village of Chicklick, Senator Chalusky. Senate Bill 549, Act making special appropriation of the Department of Administration cost of analysis of alternative designs. Myself. Senate Bill 557, an act relating to teachers, public employees, Senator Sackett. Senate Bill 621, an act providing for incentive to hire older Alaskans, Senator Sackett. Senate Bill 634, an act relating to community work as a sentence for violation of misdemeanors, Senator Dankler. Senate Bill 666, an act appropriating the operating expenses of the state government, Senator Bennett. Senate Bill 686, an act relating to the return of property recovered and seized by law enforcement agencies, Senator Dankworth. Senate Bill 689, an act relating to appropriation for general obligation bonds, Senator Sertorowski. Senate Bill 719, an act providing for the Department of Education to conduct a computer network study, Senator Churchillowski. Senate Bill 720, an act authorizing state assistance for purchase of a computer by a school district, Senator Churchillowski. Senate Bill 721, an act making special appropriation Department of Education assistance for purchase of a computer for schools, Senator Churchillowski. Senate Bill 722, an act making a special appropriation Department of Education for computer network studies, Senator Churchillowski. Senate Bill 817, an act relating to medical assistance for needy persons, Senator Ferguson. Senate Bill 851, an act repealing statutes relating to capital project funds, Senator Eliason. Senate Bill 864, an act continuing the existence of Alaska Code Commission, Senator Dankworth. Senate Bill 865, an act relating to awards of state contracts and purchases of members of minority groups, Senator Churchillowski. Senate Bill 875, an act relating to the transfer and ownership and management of the University of Alaska Trust Fund lands, Senator Stimson. Also, 876, which is the companion bill for that, Senator Stimson. Senate Bill 884, an act imposing surtax on aviation fuel, Senator Ferguson. That's it.